I'm Alec Baldwin,
and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Jody Cantor and Megan Toohey are the New York Times reporters who broke the Harvey Weinstein story. For 5 months, perpetually in danger of losing the scoop, they cultivated and cajoled sources ranging from the Weinstein's accountant to Ashley Judd. The article that emerged on October 5th, 2017, was a level-headed and impeccably sourced exposé whose effects continue to be felt around the world. Cantor and Toohey documented 25 years of sexual abuse, harassment, and exploitation by one of the most important producers in the history of Hollywood. The story put a definitive end to his career and his company. It has also shaken the lives of some of those who supported and defended him, like lawyer Lisa Bloom, who until last year had followed the path of her feminist mother, Gloria Allred, in representing victims. And just as clearly, the reporters documented the loose network of business and creative interests that enabled rape, harassment, and casting couch coercion. They revealed to America the culture in Hollywood that knew about all of this and disapproved, but expected individual women, victimized and isolated, to bear the burden of exposing the powerful men who humiliated them themselves. But before any of the fallout, Jody Cantor and Megan Toohey had to source up.
One of the first daunting tasks was to try to get in touch with these famous actresses. But Megan and I were like, we don't know any actresses, you know, and we're sitting there saying, okay, how do you get, you know, Ashley Judd's phone number?
I was going to ask you, what was the path to Ashley Judd?
Can
you talk about that?
Well, that one was pretty easy because Nick Kristoff knew her, Kristoff, the opinion columnist at the Times. But we felt strongly that we could not go through publicists or agents because they're gatekeepers. They're just going to shut everything down.
Tell me about it.
We wanted to reach the actresses directly. And so the questions were, you know, how do you reach these people? And even if you get them on the phone, what are you going to say in the first 45 seconds of that phone conversation to earn some trust and keep the conversation going? So actually, that's sort of the origin of my partnership with Megan, because Megan was on maternity leave. But she had been a sex crimes reporter for a long time, and she had done the reporting on Donald Trump and women.
At the Times?
I worked at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I worked at the Chicago Tribune. And I've been at the Times a year and a half. I came into the Times in 2016 to join the team that was doing coverage of the 2016 presidential race. So I had done these stories about Trump and his treatment of women. And after he was elected, had been part of the coverage of his when we were first looking at the ties between him and Russia. So I had been doing that work up until the March of 2017 when I had a baby and went on maternity leave. And so it was while I was on maternity leave that Jody started the Weinstein investigation and sort of called me. We didn't even know each other. And she called me and said, I know you've done stories in the past about victims of sex crimes. And I know you did reporting with some of the women who accused Trump of sexual misconduct. Do you have any suggestions of you know, how you know what to say when you're knocking on these doors and picking up the phone and calling people and to asking them to open up about these painful experiences in their past?
So when Megan and I were on the phone, she suggested a kind of argument that she had used with victims in the past, which is to say to them very early in the conversation, look, I can't change what's happened to you in the past, but if we work together, maybe we can take the pain that you experienced and put it to some constructive purpose that will help other people. And when Megan said that, it was like something clicked for me, because it's the best reason to talk to a journalist. And also, so many people fear that talking to a journalist is a bad thing, like, oh, it's traitorous, or you're a tattletale, or you're complaining, or whatever. And what we like to do is redefine it as a more noble thing. You are doing this to have a constructive impact on society. It may be very difficult, but our goal is to do something that you can eventually feel very proud of. And so that was really the beginning of our partnership.
In your book, you write about Lisa Bloom. This is Allred's daughter. I'm wondering, someone like that, what does she think she's doing? Does she go to bed every night and sit there and go, ah, ha, ha, we're pulling a fast one on everyone as I'm doing all this work for Harvey? Or does she think she's doing something else? What does she tell herself, do you think?
I mean, maybe there will be a day where Lisa Bloom comes into a studio and sits down and opens up her heart and tells us what she's been thinking and feeling and why.
You got no inkling of that in your reporting?
And why it was. I mean, what we can tell you is that, you know, she did something remarkable in 2016. She has been one of the most prominent feminist attorneys in the country, worked with countless victims of sexual harassment and sexual assault, and in 2016 crossed over to the other side.
Why do you think?
She has said that she thought that he only engaged in inappropriate comments towards women and that she wanted to help him, go work with him to help him apologize. You know, we obtained in the course of the reporting for this book these confidential records that showed she had much deeper knowledge of the serious allegations against him and that she played a much darker role. I mean, she was not honest about the work she did for him. We've got the billing records, the memo in which she spells out all the underhanded tactics she's going to use to help him undermine his accusers. And she's basically saying, I'm going to use all my experience working with victims and harness that and use it with you to work against them. And so was it just about money? I mean, what we know for sure is that she had done a deal with Weinstein. She had a book that he was going to turn into a movie about Trayvon Martin. But beyond that, I mean, she has not opened up. And when we sought comment from her for this book, I mean, we wouldn't publish, we published that memo that she wrote to him spelling out exactly what she was going to do for him, which really contradicts her public comments about what the role that she played and why she went to go work for him in its entirety so that readers could see for themselves what she was saying in her own words and doing at the time. But when we presented her with that, she refused to comment. She said that, you know, she was going to abide by attorney-client privilege into the future.
Jody.
Look, I think you're asking the right question, which is, you've got one of the most famous feminist attorneys in the country. She's Gloria Allred's daughter. She's been advertising herself as a victims' rights attorney and a fighter for women for all of these years. And she makes what we know is a very intentional decision to cross the line and work for Harvey Weinstein. And we know it's intentional because of the memo that Megan just described. This is her job audition memo, and in it she's saying, I will smear on your behalf. I will manipulate on your behalf. So the question is, what led her over? You know, what did she genuinely not believe the women she represented over the years? Did she think that Rose McGowan was just making it all up, et cetera, et cetera? So we can't look. You know, she's not here. We don't have a crystal ball, et cetera, et cetera. But here's what we can tell you, because this also applies to David Boies, the other super lawyer, the renowned litigator who did Bush v. Gore and helped get gay marriage established. Here's the common denominator that Bloom and Boies have in going to work for Weinstein. They both wanted to be in the movie business. I know. Bloom
writes... Wish they'd called me, because it's not what it's cracked up to be.
Well, Bloom writes this book called Suspicion Nation about Trayvon Martin and gets very excited because Harvey Weinstein and Jay-Z option it to turn it into a film. Boies, for all of his vast, vast, vast legal success, what does he really want to do, at least in part, is be in the movies. He's got interests in the movie business. His daughter was a budding actress and wanted roles, and we even obtained an email in which you've got Harvey sort of setting her up for a part in one of his films. And so, I mean, I think so much of this story, and this was part of my original draw to it, is about, like, what is the power that these movies have on all of us, right? Because that's the way Weinstein got everybody to do what he wanted. That was the source of his power, not just in luring people like Boies and Bloom.
I'm going to pull you into my magnetic field.
Exactly.
Here.
But also with the women, right? I mean, this was all about work. Look, it's really important to remember that there are two categories of women, essentially, that Weinstein allegedly harasses and assaults. One of them, actresses. The second, assistants, women who want to be producers, right? Women who are 23 years old and they're so excited because they're on their...
at the bottom of a ladder.
Very first day at a company like Miramax or the Weinstein Company. This is going to be their big shot. Right. It's so exciting. There's so much potential here. And then boom, Harvey Weinstein walks into the room and everything changes. And so this is all about the actresses and the assistants both. They're coming into this with dreams, with ideas, with ambitions, with hopes. And And he turns those hopes and ambitions against the women. And that has to do also with the power of the movies, the power of this work. You know, what is your ticket into this world? And how can that, you know, is your desire for entry into this world a kind of vulnerability that can then be turned against you?
No, you could, you don't, I mean, I hope I phrase this the right way, which is that I want to believe, I'm assuming in your work you unearthed some things about Weinstein that were compelling, seductive. Like when people were around him, there had to be something about him that facilitated the whole event that would happen with some of these people. He was a towering figure of accomplishment in the movie business. He was a savant who knew everything there is to know about every aspect on the deepest level of movie making, movie production, movie development, movie distribution. There are very few people. There are almost none. The only equal Weinstein has is Spielberg in terms of knowing everything there is to know about developing, casting, sets, everything. And most important of all, selling that movie and marketing that movie and that awards matrix that he dominated for so long. People thought Weinstein was a genius.
Well, we certainly witnessed Weinstein in action. We interviewed him several times. He came into the New York Times for sit-down interviews.
How did he strike you?
And he was, I think that we were able to see in person that this sort of range of this sort of the spectrum of his behavior, that he would swing from kind of charm and compliments and kind of ingratiating himself and like, well, the New York Times, it's the best paper in the world. And, you know, let me tell you a story about what a huge fan I am of the New York Times. In terms of how he was able to prey on women, I think that that is a separate question from how he was able to sort of keep people in his orbit and maintain his power. That really is one of the most important questions, is that there were actually people who got glimpses of his alleged misconduct over the years. And what did they do about it? And how can we explain the fact that there were so many individuals and institutions, including his own companies, that became complicit in his abuse? And what we were able to see is that he kind of employed a variety of personality traits from you know, sort of charm machine to threatening, to lashing out, to manipulation, to bullying. And he seemed to kind of pull these out of his pocket at various times to try to get what he had wanted. And I think that he had been able to use that. We, in our book, were able to report out this remarkable 2 years in his own company in 2014 and 2015, when there were more and more allegations coming to the surface that, you know, people high up in the company, including his own brother, Bob Weinstein, saw. He was among the people who wanted to do something and wanted to intervene. And Weinstein was really able to use a variety of tactics to ultimately shut down these efforts of accountability.
Reporters Jody Cantor and Megan Toohey. I'm Alec Baldwin, back now with reporters Jody Cantor and Megan Toohey.
I've never really worked with anyone who has had this strong an internal compass, and I think that compass has just, like, pulled us forward again and again and again. I think also that Megan is very exacting. God is in the details.
I get that.
You know, God is in the details on these stories. And I, you know, I hope our sources feel the same way I do, which is that, like, when I'm in Megan's hands, I just feel like I'm working with a world-class surgeon or something, because the level of precision is so incredibly high. I feel Megan's incredible compassion and empathy for victims, but, like, kind of wrapped in this rigor that only makes it better, because it's not about sitting around and crying. You know, that's the role of a psychologist or a friend. It's about having the strength and the force to make the story really, really work and make people feel safe through the power and the strength of the journalism. And then I think the final thing I would say is that I see a relentlessness and an understanding of the psychology of how to get people to give you information.
When, this is for Megan, when Jody Cantor comes out of the bullpen and she's heading to the mound, what is the batter afraid of? What pitches does she have in her repertoire?
I would say, I think that there's one word that comes to mind when I think of Jody, which is persistence. I sort of pity the person who's trying to get between, you know, Jody and the information that she's pursuing. And she is just, she's just a total bulldog. And it's no surprise that, you know, there was sort of a deep throat figure in the Weinstein investigation. Erwin Rieder was in the top orbit of executives by Weinstein's side for years. And ended up actually over the course of a series of secretive meetings with Jody Kantor, ended up providing all this information about the harm that Weinstein was doing to women in the company.
Why and do you ultimately, think he did that? Why?
Well, I think because he was in the hands of Jody Kantor.
No, that's not true.
I will correct that. This was somebody who had seen wrongdoing, had become increasingly concerned about it, had tried to do things to hold the boss accountable, to no avail. And so when Jody came knocking, was, I think, inclined to do something. But the extent to which, I mean, Jody, from the first email she sent to him, through the meetings that she had with him in secret in Tribeca, she was able to ultimately get him to not only start to tell her about what was going on within the company, but ultimately provide her with an internal record, a complaint that had been filed as recently as 2015 that spelled out all these extensive allegations of sexual harassment and abuse in the company. And it really is just one of the many ways in which her persistence has, like, paid off time and time again.
Jody, how'd you get him to do it?
I'll tell you the story. Erwin was at first very nervous. He grew a little more comfortable. You know, we were meeting late at night in September of 2017 at the restaurant Little Park in Tribeca. I was like, why does he want to meet in the middle of Tribeca in a fancy restaurant? But that was his spot. We always met in the same place. And he was telling me a lot, but this is what sources do, right? Very few of them sort of like tell the story in order and will know exactly what's relevant and what's not relevant. So he's telling us all this different stuff. And every few nights I'm meeting with him, I'm taking everything back to Megan. And by day, we're trying to track it down, nail it down. And I mean, a lot of it is checking out. And there was this memo that he had mentioned a few times, but I didn't know how significant it was. And he had read me a few lines from the memo, and we just thought that there might be more there. So I'm sitting there, and we're having our glasses of wine, and I said to him, will you pull up that memo on your phone again? So he pulls it up on his phone, and I think I just wanted to, like, maybe get a couple of words right or something. And he looks at me, and he says, I'm going to go to the little boy's room now. And he hands me his phone. So it's like he's telling me without explicitly telling me, take this document. Now, you never want to forward it to yourself, right? Because that's going to leave a digital trail from his email address to mine. So instead, I'm sitting there at the bar. When you have these moments in life when you're saying to your phone, don't have a technical problem. Like, please, I just need my phone to work for like the next 10 minutes.
I'm out of battery.
Yeah, exactly. So his phone is in my lap and I'm holding my phone over my lap and I'm careful to scroll so I don't like miss any lines and I'm screenshotting every page of this memo. But I still don't know what's in it because I have to work really fast because I'm trying to be all smooth. So anyway, he comes back from the bathroom a minute later and his phone is sitting and waiting for him on his chair. And, you know, we go through the rest of our drinks date. But the second he leaves, we say goodbye and he's like, I'll walk you out. And I'm like, no, you know what? I'm going to go to the ladies' room. So I go to the ladies' room and that's when I send the memo to Megan and Rebecca. And then I walk outside and I hail a cab. And that's when I actually read the memo. And the woman who wrote it, Lauren O'Connor, on top of being a very talented junior executive, she's a powerful writer. And so that memo said things like, the balance of power at this company is Harvey Weinstein 10, me 0. So it's sort of like we've been piecing together these allegations from a 25 or 30 year time period. And remember, the earliest allegation, the earliest settlement we've documented that Weinstein has paid is 1990. Think about how early that is, 1990. Lauren O'Connor, She's writing this memo in 2015, and yet it's describing some of the same things that women had experienced in 1990, in the late 90s. Like, for example, she's describing an incident at the Peninsula in Beverly Hills. Well, Ashley Judd and Gwyneth Paltrow have told us about being sexually harassed at the Peninsula in Beverly Hills by Weinstein, but their stories take place in the mid to late 90s. So it's like this sense of, how long has this guy been doing this? And we've got to publish this story because nobody else has stopped him.
Both of you, if I'm not mistaken, you both have a daughter.
Jody has two. I have one.
You have one daughter. You have two daughters. And I have an older daughter who's 23, and I have a younger daughter who's 6. And my wife and I, from time to time, think about what kind of a world will they interact with in the future.
We think about that question every day. And the confounding thing is that everything's changed and nothing's changed. Right. And I still don't have the answer.
What hasn't changed?
The laws, the structures, the systems that govern how we all behave, they just haven't changed. The difficulty of reporting one of these incidents, maybe there's a little less social stigma, but it's not fundamentally different than it was 2 years ago. Federal sexual harassment laws in this country are so weak. If you're a freelancer, you're not covered. If you work for a workplace that has fewer than 15 employees, you're not covered. So there have been a couple of adjustments to the law on the state level, but like the fundamental rules of our society have barely changed. So with respect to your question about kids, I think about our kids and I think about grandkids. And I think, you know, what are we going to tell them about this period? Are we going to say, you know, wow, Megan and I published this story and found ourselves, you know, at ground zero of a historic shift, and we can see the effects of that, you know, to this day, and it really was a window of change? Or are we going to say, well, you know, it was kind of an extraordinary period and a whole bunch of men were fired, but, you know, not that much fundamentally shifted? And then will the kids and grandkids say, oh, yeah, that, you know, sexual harassment, it still happens at my workplace all the time. It happens at my, you know, the restaurant where I wait tables during the summer. Or are they going to look at us and say, oh, my God, it used to be okay for male bosses to hit on younger female subordinates who they held workplace power over? It used to be okay in a restaurant for the male manager to grope the waitress.
Well, I wouldn't say it wasn't okay, but they got away with it.
Right. They may say, wait a second, people in Hollywood, like, they just joked about the casting couch and they just accepted it as a routine part of their business. And will they feel a kind of shock at what used to be tolerated?
Well, I want to get to that in a minute about the willingness factor, where not that they're willing, but men believe sometimes that they're willing. Megan, tell me about your crystal ball into the future, if you will.
My crystal ball into the future. I mean, You know, we are so immersed in the reporting process day in and day out. You know, the first day right after the Weinstein story broke and it started to take off, I mean, we had never anticipated that. Two nights before we went to publish, Jody and I actually stepped back. We'd been working around the clock and we actually shared a cab back to Brooklyn at about 1 o'clock in the morning. And in that silent moment, turned to each other and said, you know, do you think anybody's going to read this story? Does anybody know who Harvey Weinstein is? Is anybody going to care? So I think if you're looking for like signs that we're predictors of the future, that's certainly not the case.
Just instinctually, as women and mothers.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I think that you're actually asking the question within a pretty narrow framework. I think that we've found among our sort of male friends and colleagues that they are just as concerned, and parents of sons, I think, are just as invested in this issue. And I think that you talk to parents of daughters and sons, they will tell you that they really want to make sure that we are able to figure out, emerge from this moment with some sort of agreed upon standards that make sure that everybody is treated fairly and receives adequate protections, and that it's a safe world for, you know, the girls and the boys.
I mean, I've got three boys, a 4-year-old, a 3-year-old, and a 1-year-old. I mean, I want to go off on that tangent, but it's really remarkable how this plays into that. I'm saying to my son, going, you know, don't touch anybody without their permission. That story that I won't bore you with. But I was filming a documentary film with Jimmy Toback, who is a dear friend of mine. And in terms of sexual harassment, there's a whole pile of
Hundreds of women have accused him.
Right. Jimmy's one of those people who believe that if my batting average is 10%, I need to hit on 1,000 women. I'm not excusing his behavior, but Jimmy's somebody who I had this deep intellectual exploration with about films we were going to do. We developed a bunch of projects together. There were very few people in the world you could have the kind of conversation about movie making you could have with Jimmy. And he was a very dear, dear friend of mine. And then all this stuff comes up where they say he actually physically assaulted Selma Blair. Now, when someone is your friend, you tend to give it some credence. I am the South Shore, Long Island, middle-class white boy that I am. Someone who your friend...
I mean, like, look, if your best friend was convicted of murder, would you visit that person in jail? That's like it's a legit moral conundrum.
Right.
I think plenty of us are friends with people who have done terrible things wrong. And and that's an interesting decision, right? Like, do his sins against other people, there are arguments for and against that preventing you from having a friendship with him.
Right. But you know, Harvey Weinstein is different. I never did business with Harvey. You know, years ago, people would say blah, 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 and Oscars and this and the Weinstein Company and Miramax. And he raped Rose McGowan. Like, everybody knew that.
So what do you think explains that? Why do you think that people in your world were able to accept that for that fifth talking point with that?
But I think that that's – I myself would not use that word except because when I did the movie The Aviator that Harvey produced, I didn't even know he was involved. Scorsese himself called me. And when Marty calls you, you go. I arrived on the set in Montreal to discover that Harvey was one of the producers, but he was never there. So I do highlight the fact that accept is not the word. I mean, nobody that I know accepted anything about him.
I was so curious about something you said a minute ago, which is when you were talking about Toback, you did something really interesting, which is you kept alternating between the past and the present in terms of talking about whether he is your friend or not. You said, he was my friend, he is my friend, he was my friend, he is my friend. So would you still call him your friend? I'm just curious.
Yes. I don't know that he sexually assaulted women in auditions. I don't know that. I don't know that.
Well, so
it's like with Woody.
But to go back to your sort of distinction of, you know, it sounds like you're paying close attention to this single criminal allegation and his denial of a crime.
No, I'm only saying that there's gradations here. And I think that what Weinstein did was far worse, and he had the power to do.
There are also gradations of the victims, right? I mean, that in the case of Weinstein, he was allegedly preying on well-known famous actresses as well as, you know, lowly assistants in his companies, you know, the type of 23-year-olds that you wouldn't recognize if you passed them on the street, you know, who for the most part had sort of disappeared without a trace, without, you know, ever becoming public before this. And so the question there, I think, for you is, Selma Blair aside, these dozens of other women who have come forward, they may not be famous, but, you know, I think it's still worth learning those allegations and knowing them.
But here's what I think would be a really interesting exercise. The James Toback coverage was mainly done by the LA Times.
Right.
That's my impression.
Yes.
I would go back and read those stories and listen to the women, because it sounds like you may have missed something really important, which is the sort of audition factor involved.
Did any of them bring charges against Jimmy?
Well, remember, you're saying charges, which is a criminal word.
Any civil cases brought against Jimmy by those women? I don't know.
We'd have to go back and check because, again, it was the LA Times reporting, right, not ours. But I guess what I'm saying is I think it's worth really listening to the women's experiences, even with the stories that are allegations of sexual harassment and not violent sexual assault. There's a harm that's real, even if it isn't physical, which has to do with work, and it can play out over a very long time. Let's talk about Weinstein, because those are, you know, those are the victims we have interviewed the most thoroughly. When you talk to women who have really terrible stories of sexual harassment by Weinstein, part of what a lot of them feel now is a sense of loss and grief, because even though, you know, he's been outed, and even though there's a sense of sort of like communal accountability towards him, even though the world now knows about so many of these women's stories, what a lot of them say is that you know, I can never be 23 years old again. I can never go audition for those movies. I can never have my first job in film again. And my whole life is different because of the way he treated me. Mm-hmm. And there's really nothing that can ever change that.
Jody, how long have you worked at the Times?
I've been there a long time, like 15 years almost.
15 years.
Yeah.
And how would you describe the sexual harassment policies of the Times? Do you... does nobody sexually harass anybody at the Times?
I'll tell you what, Alec. I wouldn't, because that is not my job and that is not Megan's job. The Times has like a whole HR apparatus, right, and all these editors and leaders who deal with...
That you find satisfactory.
Yeah, because first of all, listen, everybody has been affected by Me Too. I don't think there's an organization, including we're sitting here at WNYC, which has had its own issues over time. Every organization is affected by this. It's close to all of us. There have been issues at the Times. But Megan and I have been very careful not to get involved in any of them because we've got to do our jobs. And our jobs is, you know, we're not the internal cops at the Times. Our job is to uncover this information. You know, you can't solve a problem. You can't
see. But do you see maybe there's an odd component to that where you want me to make sure I examine Jimmy Kotobek in relation to Weinstein as carefully as I should, but you don't think you need to examine the Times as carefully as Miramax or Weinstein Films?
No, because we, like, I mean, I was just curious about your personal relationship with him and your friendship. So I was just really asking a question. But I don't think in a work context, Megan and I bear, there are people at the Times who bear actual responsibility for making sure that we have sound policies for preventing and addressing this kind of behavior. That is not Megan or I.
No, I understand. Would you have a comment about that, Megan?
Yeah, I mean, there have been a variety of cases that have played out at the New York Times that have been investigated, and some have resulted in people leaving the Times. Some have resulted in people being placed on probation. Like, it is what's clear to us, and we don't know the details of those cases, but we know, like, there is evidence of accountability playing out throughout our own organization. And, you know, what we can say beyond that is just that when it comes to the reporting on sexual harassment and sexual assault at the New York Times, that, you know, we have had the support of editors and beyond, straight up to the very top of the organization. You know, this is not work that's being done just by women. This is, you know, male editors, male publishers. Our investigation straddled the passing of the baton of the publishers. Both men were like 100% in support of this, and so we feel lucky to work in an organization that has been willing to put so many resources behind this type of work.
What do you think men now need to learn about how to say to you, I'm attracted to you? Is that all going to change now? Should it change?
Well, listen, I think that there's agreement that there is a hunger for kind of a clearer sense of what the guidelines should be in the workplace, but within dating and more broadly in relations of men and women. There's no question that everybody can have sexually satisfying lives and romantic lives.
Normal
while
lives.
Also figuring out how to treat each other with respect.
Yeah,
and I
exactly.
think that that's, you know, I think that the worst thing that could happen is that people don't talk about these issues. And if they're not, whether it's with their kids or their, you know, their partners or in the workplace, and also in these interviews, you know, like, we're just so grateful that you were willing to talk to us about, for example, your relationship with Toback,
right,
and, like, thank you for engaging with us.
But that doesn't mean I don't have work to do, which you've reminded me of that again.
I mean,
I'm going to go back and read those L.A. Times pieces, and I'm going to contact the writer, the principal writer of that, see if he'll come to the show and talk about that.
I think that's a great idea. I would also just say that I think it's really important to recognize that this is really abuse of power.
Right.
This is not just a sort of sexual preference or a tool that's being used by unattractive guys because they wouldn't otherwise be able to get women.
That
this is abuse of power.
I want to end by saying that this was one of the more difficult and, on my part, least successful interviews I've ever done. Both of these writers know their subject, and my own grasp of the Me Too issue is in need of further research. The writer they refer to from the LA Times is Glenn Whipp, and we will surely invite him on and soon. In the meantime, the friction
between believe the victim and innocent until proven guilty continues. Thanks to Jodi Kantor and Megan Toohey, I am reminded that we are never done re-examining this issue and our own relationship to it. Their book about their Weinstein reporting and its fallout is called She Said, out now from Penguin Press. I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing.